And now, Xbox Magazine's Nerd of the Year, Mike Cannon.
Welcome back to the second hour of this week's Mike Cannon Show. Up next, a show I bring you each and every week about this time, This Way Out is an LGB and teen news magazine. That'll be followed by some more shorter segments I could not fit in the first hour, Media Minutes, Radio Spin, Peak Oil Check-In, Ask Mr. Green, and Black Agenda Radio are all on my agenda for the second hour. So here is This Way Out, and as always, thanks for listening to Central Wisconsin's only fully independent, non-commercial radio program, The Mike Cannon Show.
Stand by to receive our transmission.
Please abort and retry.
This is the answering services answering service. The answering service that normally supplies answering services to the system is supplying services to a sister system through a separate circuit. Since the other system is supplying services on a separate circuit, we are supplying the answering services that the other system normally provides. This sister system is ready to serve as your answering service at the beep.
Transfer of data is complete.
You've talked about your many gay friends. Would you and Michelle be comfortable attending their commitment ceremony?
We would. You know, I'll be honest with you that these days, I can't go anywhere. Sometimes since I went to a good party.
And he said, why do you have to keep saying boyfriend? He said, why do you have to rub it in our faces like that? Okay, we get it. We get that you're homosexual. And I said, I say it the same way that you've said girlfriend 5 times over the course of this conversation.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Brazil's president laments lawmakers' homophobic hypocrisy, Obama opens up on LGBT issues, and getting fully engulfed by humorist David Sedaris. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending September 20th, 2008. The president of Brazil, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, strongly defended the idea of civil unions for same-gender couples during a television interview this week. He also criticized politicians who oppose rights for lesbi-gay people but still seek their votes and take their taxes. We must stop this hypocrisy, he said, because we know they exist. There are men living with men, women living with women, and many times they live extraordinarily well. Lula became the first national leader earlier this year to launch a conference to specifically focus on lesbi-gay civil rights. Consensual adult homosexual acts have long been legal in Brazil, but homophobia and gay bashing remain significant problems in the country of 184 million people. Brazil's constitution defines marriage as between a man and a woman, and a civil unions bill granting same-gender couples many of the rights of married heterosexuals has been stalled in Brazil's Congress for more than 10 years. But battles for equality have been successful in a few Brazilian states. Rio Grande do Sul established same-gender civil unions in 2004. Rio de Janeiro grants equal benefits to the same-gender partners of state employees. And a Sao Paulo state court allowed a gay couple to adopt a 5-year-old girl in late 2006. A series of court rulings in the predominantly Roman Catholic country have also given gay and lesbian couples some rights in areas such as immigration, welfare, pensions, and inheritance.
The Paris AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, ACT UP, protested Roman Catholic Pope Benedict XVI prior to a mass he conducted during his visit to the city last week. Benedict regularly denounces same-gender couples, and the church has consistently opposed the use of condoms to prevent HIV/AIDS. The protesters erected a large banner which read, "The condom is life," and laid a large black and pink carpet down the stairs of the venue to, as they said in a statement, denounce the obscenity of the red carpet deployed in Paris by President Nicolas Sarkozy for Benedict XVI and his reactionary theses. Opposing condom use, they charged, amounts to facilitation of evil. There were reports that LGBT and AIDS advocacy groups were under extensive surveillance prior to the Pope's visit.
At least 5% of gay men in Beijing are HIV positive, and too many gay men are having unsafe sex, according to a statement issued earlier this month by the Beijing Center for Disease Control and Prevention. Deputy Director He Zhang told reporters that local gay men use condoms less than 50% of the time when they have sex. Meanwhile, he said, infection rates have dropped from needle sharing, blood products, and mother-to-child transmission. The number of HIV cases in China has always been unclear, but it's believed to be at least 650,000, according to the Ministry of Health and international health organizations.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, announced last month that the annual number of HIV infections in the country is 40% higher than previously thought. The agency confirmed during a conference call with reporters last week that the highest rates of new infection are among Black, gay, and bisexual men, especially those under 29 years old. Of the more than 56,000 Americans diagnosed with HIV in 2006, 72% were gay and bisexual men. Of those men, 46% were white, 35% were Black, and 19% were Hispanic. The new figures also show a much higher HIV rate among women of color than for white women. Kevin Fenton, director of the HIV/AIDS division at the CDC, called the new data about Black gay men alarming and said that 80% of them never come in contact with CDC-approved HIV prevention programs. But only 2 of 18 CDC programs specifically target Black, gay, and bisexual men. Activists have consistently criticized the CDC for long ignoring the group most affected by HIV. Cornelius Baker, national policy advisor for the National Black Gay Men's Advocacy Coalition, said in a statement that, despite continuously accumulating data, there has been little commitment from policymakers and elected officials at the federal, state, or local level. The silence still equals death.
An Australian government report this week announced an almost 50% increase in the number of HIV/AIDS cases in that country over the past 8 years. It says the surge is in large part due to Australian gay men bringing the virus home with them after vacationing in Asian countries with high HIV infection rates, such as Thailand, Papua New Guinea, and Fiji. The report by the National Center in HIV Epidemiology and Clinical Research was also critical of the federal government, noting that Australia was once among the world's leaders in HIV/AIDS education, but the cutbacks in funding have crippled prevention efforts.
A report in the UK, National Guidelines for HIV Testing 2008, is recommending that sexually active gay men be tested for HIV at least once every 12 months. Recent figures show that more than 30% of gay or bisexual men living with HIV there don't know they are infected. The National AIDS Trust, the UK's leading independent HIV/AIDS advocacy group, endorsed the new guidelines. It reported earlier this year that symptoms of early-stage HIV infection are routinely misdiagnosed by doctors. It also found that 30 to 50% of new HIV infections are thought to be passed on by people in the early stage of infection, so the need to catch new cases early in order to prevent the spread of HIV is a top priority. The new testing guidelines were published by the British HIV Association, British Infection Society, and the British Association of Sexual Health and HIV.
In other news, John Burnside, longtime partner of the late LGBT rights pioneer Harry Hay and an activist in his own right, died on September 14th at his home in San Francisco. He was 91. Hay died in 2002 at the age of 90. Longtime friend Joey Kane told the Los Angeles Times that Burnside was in declining health and had recently been diagnosed with spongioblastoma brain cancer. In his early career, Burnside's interest in optical engineering led him to invent the kaleidoscope, a variation on the kaleidoscope that transforms what the viewer sees into a colorful design without the use of colored glass chips. His California Kaleidoscopes became a successful design and manufacturing company in Los Angeles. He later created the Symmetricon, a large kaleidoscopic device that projects patterns, which was used in several Hollywood films. But it is for his relationship with Harry Hay that LGBT people will best remember Burnside. Hay led a handful of men who formed the Mattachine Society, a pioneering gay rights organization in Los Angeles in the 1950s. Burnside met Hay in 1963, and after what was called a whirlwind romance, they moved in together and remained a couple for 39 years.
Hay and Burnside were a highly visible activist couple in Los Angeles throughout the 1960s. They founded the Southern California Council on Religion and the Homophile in 1965, and a year later took part in one of the country's first gay rights demonstrations, a 15-car motorcade through downtown Los Angeles to protest the ban on gay men serving in the military. But they were also active in the anti-war movement. In 1979, frustrated by what they saw as the queer rights movement's drift toward mainstream assimilation, the couple helped organize the first spiritual gathering of radical fairies at an ashram near Tucson, Arizona. Since that first event, which drew about 200 men, the fairy movement has held dozens of gatherings around the world. "The people who have come to the gatherings came looking to find themselves," Burnside once said, "but they found each other, too." The couple relocated to San Francisco after Hayes' health declined. A group of radical fairies, dubbed the Circle of Loving Companions, cared for the two men during their final years. Mark Thompson, a well-known lesbi-gay historian and longtime friend of Burnside's, told The Times that Hay and Burnside were totally committed to peace and justice issues on a wide spectrum of social concerns, including Native American rights, women's and labor issues, fair employment and housing. They were just good social activists. Plans for a memorial service in San Francisco for John Burnside are pending.
And finally, U.S. televangelist Pat Robertson and other holier-than-thou homophobes often warn that God uses bad weather to punish those who accept gays and lesbians. So he'll have a hard time explaining why one of the few businesses left standing in the wake of Hurricane Ike, which devastated Galveston, Texas last week, was Robert's Lafitte, a gay bar. It's become a major gathering spot now in the city of 60,000. Some 20,000 people are thought to still be on the island, and emergency workers are on the scene. Food and water remain scarce, and residents have been told that it could be months before full power is restored and the city is up and running again. People have been dropping off food and other necessities at the bar for anyone who needs them. Brian DeLeon, a grateful self-identified heterosexual, told the Reuters news service that he'd never thought of entering the bar before, but that "these are the people who take you up out of the water and make life livable. Once I get back to work, I'm coming back here." The bar's owner, known locally as Big Mouth Robert, told Reuters that the building was flooded with about 3 feet of brackish water, but after mopping up, the bar reopened the next day. They're even offering a drag show, and in an apparent salute to the woman who was also notoriously battered by another Ike, her husband at the time, a Tina Turner sing-along. Big Mouth Robert summed it up nicely. "We're survivors," he said.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 20th, 2008. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Pam Marshall.
You'll hear things a best-selling author will never know about himself later in the program. The venerable LGBT weekly Philadelphia Gay News tried for some time to arrange interviews with the two major candidates for U.S. president, Republican Senator John McCain and Democratic Senator Barack Obama. According to publisher Mark Segal, it became clear that McCain would not participate, and the decision was made to go forward with an Obama exclusive. Segal questioned the senator about how an Obama administration would approach several LGBT issues and about his historic campaign.
"You're the most LGBT-friendly candidate running for president in history. Are you concerned that John McCain and the Republicans might use this as a divisive issue as they did in 2004?
No. I mean, I think they can try, but I don't think it'll work for a couple of reasons. Number one, yeah, I think that the American people's attitudes with respect to LGBT issues are continuing to evolve, but I think that they are, you know, people are becoming more and more aware of the need to treat all people equally, regardless of sexual orientation. There's some people who disagree with that, but frankly, those folks probably, you know, many of them, probably had already made up their minds about this election earlier.
You've talked about your many gay friends. Would you and Michelle be comfortable attending their commitment ceremony?
We would. I'll be honest with you that these days I can't go anywhere.
Well, you can take your Secret Service guards with you.
Long time since I went to a good party.
The current President Bush has used signing orders to change military rules and regulations. If White House counsel advised you that you could end Don't Ask, Don't Tell by attaching a signing order to a military appropriations bill, would you?
You know, I would not do it that way. And the reason is because I want to make sure that when we reverse Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we have built the, it's gone through a process, and we built a consensus, or at least a clarity about, you know, what my expectations are, so that it works. I mean, my first obligation as president is to make sure that I keep the American people safe and that our military is functioning effectively. And, you know, although I have consistently said I would repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I believe that the way to do it is to make sure that we are working through processes, getting the Joint Chiefs of Staff clear in terms of what our priorities are going to be. And, you know, that was, that's how we were able to integrate the armed services, to get women more actively involved in the armed services. At some point, you've got to make a decision that that's the right thing to do, but you always want to make sure that you're doing it in a way that maintains our core mission in our military.
Many lawyers contend that the Defense of Marriage Act passed by Congress is unconstitutional. It takes away over 1,100 rights, including IRS joint filings. If a suit is filed in federal court, would you expect or up to your attorney general to join in that suit with an amicus brief questioning its legality?
You know, I would want to review carefully any lawsuit that was filed. You know, this is probably my carryover from being a constitutional lawyer. But here's what I can tell you. My principle is DOMA, I think, was an unnecessary encroachment by the federal government in an area traditionally reserved for the states. I think that it was primarily sent as a message to score political points instead of work through these difficult issues. I recognize why it was done, and you know, I'm sympathetic to the political pressures involved, but you know, I think that we need to bring it to a close. And, you know, my preference would be to work through a legislative solution. But, you know, if the court, I would also point out that if it's going before this court, I'm not sure what chances would have to be overturned. So I think we're going to have to take a different approach. But I'm absolutely committed to the concept that it's unnecessary.
In last year's history project, Elaine Noble, who's one of the first elected officials in the country, referring to her discussions with Harvey Milk, said, "I think we both knew that one of us was going to die." Milk, of course, was killed. As the first African-American president, have you and Michelle discussed this?
You know, we don't spend time worrying about security issues. We have Secret Service protection, which is the best in the world, and obviously, we take precautions and listen to them, but, you know, what I spend the day thinking about is, how do I get my message out that we need to change this country to make it more just and more fair, to make sure the economy is growing on behalf of middle-class Americans, make sure kids can go to college, that we're bringing this war in Iraq to an end. That's what I spend my time thinking about.
Okay. In the wake of the torture murder of Matthew Shepard, Senator McCain voted against adding sexual orientation to the definition of hate crimes and says he'll vote against it again. Isn't this inconsistent for a man who knows torture?
Well, you'll have to ask Senator McCain that. Here's what I can say is that, you know, there's no doubt that hate crimes based on sexual orientation are all too prevalent. It is something that we have to hit back hard against, and identifying these vicious crimes for what they are, hate crimes, is something that I believe in and will continue to believe in when I'm president.
President Reagan, President Bush, and President Clinton, when meeting world leaders, have raised human rights questions. Amnesty International has documented countries that imprison, torture, and kill gay men, some of which are very close U.S. allies. Would you be willing to raise that question when meeting with those leaders?
I think that the treatment of gays and lesbians, transgender persons, is a part of the broader human rights discussion. And, you know, I think it is not acceptable that we would in any way carve out exceptions for our broader human rights advocacy to exclude violations of human rights based on sexual orientation. I think that has to be part and parcel of any conversation that we have about human rights.
That was an exclusive Philadelphia Gay News interview by publisher Mark Segal with Democratic U.S. presidential candidate Barack Obama.
Hello, I'm Carol.
And I'm Maria.
And together we're Zrazy.
And we're crazy about This Way Out,
the international lesbian and gay radio magazine.
April in Paris, chestnuts in blossom.
The latest book by public radio humorist David Sedaris is called When You're Fully Engulfed in Flames, a title he discovered in a Tokyo hotel's English language safety guide. It was burning brightly at the top of the bestseller list during his tour of Australia when he encountered This Way Out correspondent John Frame in Brisbane.
You're here to talk about your latest book, When You Are Engulfed in Flames. Now, I've had a listen to the audiobook over the last couple of days, and it's a really diverse book. It's a good exercise, isn't it?
I like books on tape, but not my own. Like, I've never listened to my own, but other people's I do. And I like the way that when you listen to a book, I like the way that it befalls you. Because when I listen to a book, I think of that book. Like, for instance, I just finished listening to some Jonathan Franzen essays, right? He wrote a book called How to Be Alone. And when I think about that book, I think of the countryside in Normandy, because that's where I walked through the countryside listening to that book. So I associate it with a bucolic landscape. Or other books I associate with ironing, or hotel rooms in the United States. But when you read a book, it's rare to associate a book with a play. You don't like to think, oh, I remember I was lying on that couch when I read that book. But when you're out in the world, like, books on tape allow you to be out in the world and be in the book at the same time. I like that.
When you first listened to your own voice in a national public radio broadcast, I believe, you were lying in bed with your head under a pillow. Have you gotten more used to your own voice these days?
No. No, I accidentally listened to part of a radio broadcast a couple of years ago, and that was it. Cannot. If I get call my house and I get my voice on the answering machine, I'm depressed for weeks. Can't do it. But I write for a magazine called The New Yorker, and you can get The New Yorker. You can get an Audible version, and so it's these people, and they're not actors necessarily, but they read every word of the magazine. So whenever I have a story in there, somebody will read it. And I actually enjoy listening to those versions because it's not the way I would read a story. You know, I would read that particular story, or I was reading something the other night. I was listening to something the other night, and it was about a babysitter that we had growing up. And the voice that this person gave the babysitter was like not the voice at all that I gave her, that I remember her having. But that didn't bother me. I was able to hear the story and hear faults in the story and hear good things about the story by hearing it out loud. But if I tried to listen to my recording of it, then I wouldn't have been able to get past my voice.
But for us, we get to hear what you actually sound like. When you can write that you do Billie Holiday impersonations, but we can hear that you really do a very good version, don't you?
You know, I don't think it's that good. I used to think it was good, and then I heard it. And then I thought, oh, no, that's like, you know, there's a way you sound in your head, and there's a way you really sound, and I mistook the two.
Now, Australia would have no trouble after watching the 7:30 report on Australia's national broadcast of the ABC the other night, no trouble knowing that you are, in fact, a homosexual. And do you find that it's surprising as you travel around the world that people will point to your sexuality as a prime subject?
You know, I don't really feel like they do, but it was interesting. I just finished a long book tour, and golly, I lost track of all the radio interviews I did and, you know, the TV a couple of times. And I never felt like anyone made it, that it was a big deal. Like somebody, but then I was in Canada, and I was interviewed by this fellow for a newspaper in Canada, And he said, why do you have to keep saying boyfriend? He said, why do you have to rub it in our faces like that? Okay, we get it. We get that you're homosexual, okay? And I said, well, I say it the same way that you've said girlfriend five times over the course of this conversation. Like, or that I say it the same way that someone might say my husband or my wife. Like, I'm not expecting it to be any big deal. You know, it's just a person that features in a lot of my stories and that features prominently in my life. And so I say boyfriend. I didn't think anything of it. And I never read anything about myself. Like, I never read any reviews. I don't read interviews ever. But there was something about this guy, and I liked him, you know, but I was curious, too, and what his writing was like. And I was at the airport the next day, and I thought, well, his article came out. I'm just gonna see. And he described me as slight and effeminate. And effeminate, you know, like if you're gay, like when you hear effeminate, and there are people that conjures a mental picture, and there are people that I can think of that would, but I thought, really? Am I? But then I thought, well, maybe he was just like such a he-man, and like he had such a problem with like the word boyfriend, that maybe that's where that came from. But really, that was the only time that I ever felt any weirdness or any hostility or anything about that. It's striking to me, right? Because I'm 51. So at the time that I grew up, and especially growing up in North Carolina, if you had the word boyfriend in a book and you were a man, then your book would be in the homosexual section. Well, there wouldn't even be a homosexual, so your book wouldn't even be in the library. It would vanish from the library. It would not be in the bookstore. I don't know how people would. And a little later on, then it would have been in the gay section of the bookstore. You know, that doesn't mean you talked about sex or anything. You used the word penis or anything, but you had the word boyfriend. So you would be in the homosexual section. And it's pretty remarkable to me just over the course of my lifetime how that has changed, right? And now you can just be at the bookstore at large. You know, you can just be in the nonfiction section or in the fiction section or in the humor section. And so it's interesting sometimes to go into a bookstore and see where the book is. You know, because there are still people who will say, oh, well, that's in the gay section because you're gay. And so it's like, well, would you have a black section, you know, like where everybody who's black is? Or do you have, like, a women with curly hair section? Like, but to me, just in the 50 years since I've been alive, like, who could have imagined those changes? You know, who could have imagined? I mean, I certainly could not have. It seems huge to me.
John Frame will pick up with David Sedaris where they left off, talking about his brand of subtle activism.
But I thought to, like, screech at people, I didn't think that was going to get me anywhere. But if you could just sort of write stories about your boyfriend when he was pertinent to the story, or write about being gay when it was pertinent to the story, that seemed better, because then you would have people say, well, there's that guy on the radio, and I like him, and he's a homosexual, so I don't see what all the big deal is about.
More with the author of When You're Fully Engulfed in Flames next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Chris Wilson, Pam Marshall, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and John Frame contributed program material. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is made possible by charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org. You can also subscribe to CDs or cassettes of all our programs there. To receive our weekly email alerts, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappelle. Thanks for listening on WSUI Iowa City, Iowa, KZSC Santa Cruz, California, 2NUR Newcastle, New South Wales, and more than 175 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all, stay tuned.
This is 93.3 WMRB Wausau. Free People Free Radio.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Remember those empty, static-filled channels on the TV dial? Those so-called white spaces may be the key to bringing high-speed broadband to the millions of Americans who are still stuck on the wrong side of the digital divide. At one time, TV technology needed to have an extra buffer on each side of a working channel to prevent interference from other stations. But technology now exists to use these spaces without harming the reception of existing channels. The Wireless Innovation Alliance is comprised of public interest groups like Public Knowledge and private tech companies like Google and Microsoft. Members want to open these unused airwaves to unlicensed devices that would provide a new way to get online. This week, they came to Capitol Hill for White Spaces Day to educate lawmakers about the need for open, unlicensed bandwidth. Timothy Carr, campaign director of Free Press, a member of the alliance, said much of the spectrum on the broadcast dial is being wasted.
And if you go to a place like Juneau, Alaska, you'll find that more than 74% of the spectrum is available for use. And even in a city as crowded as New York City, you find that 20% of the spectrum is available. So it presents this great opportunity to get millions of people connected.
But there are those who don't want these public airwaves to actually be used by the public.
You have very powerful corporate lobbies like the National Association of Broadcasters that wants to hoard spectrum. They want to have as much control over spectrum as possible. Even though they don't know what to do with it, they see it as a valuable asset. So they're deploying their lobbyists. They've been spending mountains of money on lawyers and misinformation campaigns to basically confuse people in Washington and to kind of manhandle and convince them that they shouldn't make this valuable spectrum available for other uses.
At the same time, the cell phone industry is pushing for the spectrum to be licensed and auctioned off to the highest bidder. But that plan would stifle new innovations and crush the promise of the airwaves that some have characterized as Wi-Fi on steroids. Carr cautions lawmakers and citizens not to be taken in by the industry spin.
It's an issue that Americans should really care about. So people in cities across the country, from Juneau to New York City, need to really get involved and tell their members of Congress that unless we use white spaces for unlicensed internet access, we are going to miss out on one of our last great opportunities to get the internet to everyone.
For more information about white spaces and links to contact your representatives, go to freepress.net/whitespaces.
In South Bend, Indiana, Shores Communications owns the CBS TV affiliate, the only daily newspaper, the South Bend Tribune, the only news radio station, and another radio station. But they want even more. The company wants to buy three more TV stations, including the ABC affiliate, giving them a near total monopoly on news and information in the area. The sale would result in Shores controlling an overwhelming 81% of the South Bend news market. Media Access Project filed a petition to deny the sale with the Federal Communications Commission on behalf of the media watchdog group Free Press. Josh Luthold, a South Bend native, signed on to the petition because he feels the area is already lacking in diverse news sources.
Most of the local news is owned by just a few companies, Shirts Communications being the biggest one. The bulk of our news is from Chicago. The local stuff, it mostly gets influenced by local politics, which in this area is very conservative.
It was the news reporting in the aftermath of September 11th that got Luthold thinking about the state of the media.
That's when the big change in American policy happened. And nobody was asking anything with regards to our reaction. Everybody thought it was okay that we were reacting the way we were as a country. And that's all you got from the cable news networks. And that's all you got from the local news networks around here. And that's all that came out of Chicago in this area. That's all you heard anywhere until you went online. And then if you go online and you start searching for things, you start finding all these questions that are being asked about what we're doing, about Guantanamo Bay, about everything.
He says most people don't get involved in issues like media reform because they don't know they can.
I don't know how most people's schooling, what they were taught, but typically I was taught that while we have control, no one ever explained to us how we had control. And they never said that you could write to your representative. They never showed you how to write to your representative. So things like this, when you actually find a way to be able to say something, I usually latch on to those because I feel it's important in a democracy for the people to actually have their voice heard.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
Welcome to the Weekly Radio Spin, a look at the stories behind the news, brought to you by the Center for Media and Democracy. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Diane Farsetta. In our top spin, a former chief investigator for Iraq's Commission on Public Integrity testified that over $13 billion that the U.S. sent to Iraq for reconstruction projects has been wasted, stolen, or diverted to al-Qaeda in Iraq. The investigator told the U.S. Senate's Democratic Policy Committee that billions were spent on fictitious projects and on efforts where U.S. and Iraqi contractors did unacceptably shoddy work. In one case, the U.S. spent nearly $25 million on an electricity project, but it, quote, existed only on paper, end quote. The investigator added that he personally saw waste of U.S. funds and that he was eventually forced to flee Iraq because of death threats.
Irony is alive and well in the Big Easy. Louisiana's state Senate just appointed former lobbyist and Democratic congressional aide Gary Heimel to the Louisiana Board of Ethics. The board's role is to interpret and enforce ethical standards, including electoral campaign finance and lobbyist disclosure laws. Heimel was a lobbyist with Hill & Knowlton and worked on behalf of Turkey and Indonesia when both countries needed help downplaying human rights abuses. He also worked on behalf of Citizens for a Free Kuwait, a front group bankrolled by the Kuwaiti royal family to press for U.S. intervention against Iraq. Heimel was also one of several Hill & Knowlton consultants that worked to salvage Enron after its collapse.
After a lot of discussion and confusion about whether plastics are safe, especially in baby products, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration announced that the plastic bisphenol A carries no health risks. But their decision is based on research funded by the chemical industry. In fact, one of the studies the agency relied on was conducted by employees of Dow Chemical, which manufactures bisphenol A. The FDA ignored numerous independent and government-funded studies that show risks for fetuses, developing infants, and children, as well as an increased risk of diabetes and heart disease for adults. Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa has demanded that the FDA explain how they decided which studies to use and which to ignore.
According to documents leaked to the Guardian newspaper, the British government has been actively trying to undermine the European Union's plan to reduce carbon emissions to combat climate change. The UK wants to be able to count more imported carbon credits in order to meet pollution reduction targets. The documents indicate that if Britain has its way, Europe could emit an extra billion tons of CO2 over a 7-year period. Environmentalists are furious. The leader of Britain's Green Party said, quote, "It shows how much of the political talk on climate is empty rhetoric when you have the UK talking up the need for action on one hand and carrying out this kind of irresponsible climate vandalism on the other," end quote.
And now it's time to play 6 Degrees of Spin and Fakin, our look at the connections between media manipulators. Earlier, we mentioned the Hill & Knowlton public relations firm and their work for Citizens for a Free Kuwait. One of the stories used to gain U.S. public support for the first Gulf War was completely engineered by Hill & Knowlton. In October 1990, a 15-year-old girl named Naira testified about atrocities that she claimed to have witnessed in front of what seemed to be a congressional committee. Here's a clip of her testimony.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
But appearances can be deceiving. The group was the House Human Rights Caucus, not an official congressional committee. Its co-chairs also headed another group that occupied free office space in Hill & Knowlton's Washington, D.C. office. And Naira? She was actually the niece of the Kuwaiti ambassador to the United States and part of the Kuwaiti royal family. She had been coached in her false testimony by Hill & Knowlton. There is absolutely no evidence that her story was true, but it was repeated widely by the media, by President George H.W. Bush, and even at the United Nations. It also succeeded in getting the U.S. public to support the first Gulf War.
That's this week's edition of the Weekly Radio Spin. For more information, visit the Center for Media and Democracy's website at www.prwatch.org.
Thank you. And now the winner of the Best Central Wisconsin Community Radio Station is voted by us computer voices, WNRB.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham. As outrage grows over the $700 billion Wall Street bailout proposal, workers, their unions, and political progressives are hitting the streets in protest nationwide. They're demanding that if Congress spends those billions, that workers are protected and jobs created. Labor rallied on Wall Street on Thursday. New York City Central Labor Council Executive Director Ed Ott.
They took over a government that had surpluses and a balanced budget, and they've run it into the ground. If they're going to do a bailout and give $700+ billion to Wall Street, we want them to repeal the Bush tax cuts and take that money and begin to put it towards infrastructure projects, mass transit, healthcare, schools, roads, highways. Get the economy going again.
AFL-CIO Policy Director Thea Lee says some financial bailout action is needed or else workers will be hurt even more than they're already hurting. She says here's what the AFL-CIO wants to see happen.
We need to make sure that we are not throwing away taxpayers' money, that we are not rewarding the people who got us into this problem in the first place, that we are taking care of the real economy, the productive economy that is Main Street. We think it's extremely important to do two things in the context of this. One is to pass a second economic stimulus, a jobs program, extend unemployment insurance for all those many millions of people who are about to exhaust their unemployment insurance. The other piece is also to ensure that we are really helping the homeowners stay in their homes.
The Economic Policy Institute's Josh Bivens says while working people are angry about the idea of a $700 billion Wall Street bailout, doing nothing would definitely hurt working families.
And if we get, you know, complete meltdown in the credit markets the way people fear, essentially what that means is no bank trusts any other bank. Instruments that firms just use to meet their payroll every week will not go through, and you're going to see just even more layoffs and more distress in the job market than we're already seeing.
A strike by 27,000 Boeing workers has entered its fourth week, Jesse Russell reports.
The Boeing workers have been on strike since September 6th, and while company officials are speaking to a federal mediator, no new talks have been scheduled between the International Association of Machinists and the company. The workers are seeking job security and a wage increase of 13%. The company has refused to meet the union's demands for a fair contract, resulting in the workers walking off the job. As a result of Boeing's unwillingness to come back to the table with a fair offer, many subcontractors that build parts for Boeing have been feeling ripple effects from the strike and have begun laying off workers.
Teamsters in Milwaukee are into the fourth week of their strike against waste management. Pensions are a big issue. Teamster 200's Tom Benvenuto says the striking workers just want a fair contract.
Unless the company can come up with an alternative equal retirement package, our guys are saying no.
Workers Independent News Week in Review. I'm Doug Cunningham.
Peak Oil Check-In, exploring the end of the age of oil.
Last week, I described on the Peak Oil Check-In a situation that wasn't getting much play in the national media. Regional shortages of gasoline and other refined products in the wake of Hurricanes Gustav and Ike. This week, the national media are paying some attention, even though the larger story of the meltdown of the U.S. financial sector is, rightfully, dominating headlines. The U.S. paper of record, the New York Times, had a short article on Sunday reporting fuel shortages and long gas lines in Atlanta, Nashville, and Tallahassee. The article quoted Jason Toews, founder of GasBuddy.com, as predicting the shortages would last another week or two. Local reporting confirms the view in the Times. The website of the NBC TV affiliate in Atlanta said Monday that many gas stations there that did have gas had only a single pump open, or were offering only a single grade of gasoline. In response to the shortages, the Nashville City Paper published an editorial Monday that I like so much, I thought I would read an unusually long excerpt of it. The editorial's philosophy is equally applicable to the acute shortages now being experienced in the Southeast, the chronic fuel shortages we're all likely to face as world oil production drops after peak oil, and the financial sector's meltdown. The headline of the Nashville City Paper's editorial is, "Governments Should Keep Populace Informed on Gasoline." Here's some of what it says. As America tries to change its attitude about energy sources and consumption, it is imperative that governments keep up, not just in terms of regulations, but in guiding the populace. After all, what is leadership, or governance for that matter, other than guidance? How about if governments started the process with just a little old-fashioned information and some accompanying suggestions? There was a growing sense of panic in Nashville and surrounding Middle Tennessee counties last week that hit a crescendo Friday around lunchtime. The problem? The region was clearly running out of gasoline. Filling station after station sat with cellophane bags draped over pump handles. Angry motorists, many of them working-class folks, sat idly in long lines that stretched down city blocks, waiting for their turn at gas stations lucky enough to have product. Gasoline has slowly started making its way back to Middle Tennessee pumps. The question now is, what have we as a community learned from this mess? Let's start with a lesson for governments, both state and local. Government does not need to treat gasoline availability like a market issue. Government needs to stay on top of the gasoline availability issue and communicate at length with the public when a shortfall is anticipated. Last week, Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen's office rolled out an explanation late Friday, which read like an admonition to essentially stay calm. What was needed was for some arm of the Tennessee government to be more aware than the general populace that this kind of shortage of a very essential commodity was going to happen. The next step would then be to over-communicate the facts to people directly and to the media. The lesson for government is that nature abhors a vacuum. In the absence of good proactive information from our elected leaders on this kind of crisis, people will simply do what feels safe and prudent. This may not always be the right answer. It is all too likely this kind of issue will become more a fact of modern life and not less of one. Our world is changing in its disposition towards energy consumption, which is a very positive thing. At the same time, current energy sources are becoming scarcer and now subject to the whims of natural disasters. Government cannot make gasoline exist that does not exist. At the same time, as government does with many other issues, it should include fuel availability as one of the factors it watches on our behalf. So says the Nashville City Paper in an editorial published Monday. Information on long-term fuel availability is also important for government to provide and for the media to over-communicate, as the city paper puts it. Neither of the major presidential candidates has had the courage to warn the country that oil supplies may well be constricted within the decade. And as far as I'm aware, New York Governor David Paterson is the only one of the nation's 50 governors who has addressed peak oil. And oh, it would have been nice to have had some more information about the state of the financial sector before an emergency request for a $1 trillion bailout. I'm Carl Etnayer, and that's this week's Peak Oil Check-In.
Peak Oil Check-In was produced by Relocalizing Vermont Productions in association with WGDR Plainfield.
It's time to ask Mr. Green from the Sierra Club. Gabrielle in Oakland, California asks, "Hey, Mr. Green, I'm trying to convince my husband that using the dishwasher is more efficient than washing each dish separately. Is that true?"
Well, although it shatters the code of macho solidarity, Mr. Green is duty-bound to report that you are right. He is wrong. Washing dishes by hand uses about twice the water and energy of a modern dishwasher. According to the EPA, a dishwasher will typically save 5,000 gallons of water, $40 in utility costs, and 230 hours of your time in a year. Of course, we're talking about a full load in the machine. If you put only a few dishes in there and run it through a cycle, hand washing could win. Also, we're assuming that water isn't wasted by unnecessary rinsing of dishes before placing them in a dishwasher. Scraping crud off with a spatula or lightly rinsing is all you need to do, provided you don't delay and let the stuff dry out and glue itself to the utensils.
Ask Mr. Green to learn a lot more online at sierraclubradio.org.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show,
It's time to ask Mr. Green from the Sierra Club. Joyce in Charleston, South Carolina asks, "Hey, Mr. Green, if I scavenge firewood instead of buying it, is it better to heat my house by burning wood in my fireplace or by using electricity from traditional sources?"
Well, Joyce, first, don't burn wood very often unless you have an EPA-approved fireplace, box, or stove. A wood fire can be a dangerously polluting proposition, which is why some towns have banned it, especially in regions with high level of soot or particulate matter pollution. Environmentally scavenged wood is all right as long as it wasn't painted or treated, in which case burning it could release dangerous substances like, say, arsenic. If you're scavenging from a forest or woodlot, don't hog all the dead wood. Healthy forests need it to feed bugs and other critters that are important in the food chain of the forest ecology. In the grand scheme of things, it's hard to say which is best. Wood is a renewable resource, but it exposes you and your neighbors to a lot more pollution than electricity.
Ask Mr. Green and learn a lot more online at sierraclubradio.org.
In the eminently forgettable 1985 comedy Brewster's Millions, Richard Pryor played a man who received an odd bequest. If he spent $30 million in 30 days, he would receive $300 million. The catch was that he had to spend the money without accumulating any assets. The Bush administration plan for dealing with the potential meltdown of the financial sector is to give Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, and or his successor, $700 billion to spend over 2 years. He's supposed to spend it on accumulating the lowest quality assets around, the right to collect on bad debts and derivatives associated with those rights. The payoff, unlike the case for Richard Pryor, will be a whopping increase in the national debt. The Bush administration's initial draft proposal gives all power to the Treasury Secretary, with only the vaguest mention of oversight, to spend the money as he chooses. He can choose what personnel or private firms he wants to implement the plan, and he can buy mortgage-backed securities on any terms he wants. The proposal reminds me of the authorization for the use of military force passed by Congress a week after the 9/11 attacks. Yes, there had been a serious attack and everyone was jittery expecting another one, and something was definitely going to be done. But the Bush administration seized on the chance to push through a several-paragraph resolution that basically authorized the president to, quote, use all necessary and appropriate force, the necessity and appropriateness to be determined solely by him, against anyone who he determined, through whatever process he chose, to be involved with the 9/11 attacks in any way or to be harboring anyone involved with them. Bush was pushing an open door. It passed the House and Senate with only one dissenting vote, that of Barbara Lee. And yet, even if Dennis Kucinich and Cynthia McKinney and Russ Feingold were in favor of the Afghanistan war, already an obvious prospect at that time, they apparently never stopped to think that the authority granted was much wider. When the administration gave itself the right to declare U.S. citizens enemy combatants and hold them indefinitely without right of habeas corpus or due process, it cited the authorization. This time around, the Democrats are slightly more critical. It's clear they'll allow this bailout to be rammed through, but they will exact some concessions. They may require relief for homeowners who can't make their mortgage payments, some conditionalities to companies seeking federal relief, and or an economic stimulus package. One proposal getting a lot of play is to limit executive pay in companies getting relief. As emotionally satisfying as this would be, it's unfortunately small potatoes compared to the size of the bailout. The same is true for the other concessions the Democrats are likely to seek. Although assets acquired by the government can later be sold if markets revive, it seems clear that the logic of the bailout is going to require massive losses. In the short term, just reviving liquidity in these markets may help distressed companies. But if their bad securities are bought up at actual market prices, how will this help their balance sheets? Presumably, the government will buy assets at inflated prices and then sell them for lower prices in the future. It is clear that something needs to be done. While some on the left may see Wall Street on fire right now and be tempted to say, let the mother burn, only a fanatic could truly hold to that. A serious meltdown could trigger widespread economic dislocation and recession. The government should be providing the market with a controlled landing while appropriating as many of the profits as possible, given that it is assuming all of the risk. Unfortunately, the bailout actually seems designed to allow quick resumption of the status quo. 2 years from now, somewhat chastened and with leveraging back to 10-1 instead of 30-1 or more, the moguls of Wall Street will be dreaming up new ways to bamboozle people, create systemic risk, and cash in. John McCain is already pushing privatization of Social Security, Wall Street's wet dream. The price for the rescue of the status quo in a country already in trouble because of its lack of willingness to invest in the future and in the welfare of the average citizen will be a sour atmosphere of fiscal retrenchment in Washington. Expect that for years to come, significant spending on universal health care, vital infrastructure, development of alternative energy sources will be all but politically impossible. The only thing likely to be exempt from extreme fiscal discipline will be money for war. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Where is it?
I just wanted you to go and A&R it, yes. Okay, I'll try it, okay?
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so f***ing crazy you can't follow the rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When they've tortured and scared you for 20 odd years, then they expect you to pick a career. When you can't really function, you're so full of fear. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. Keep you doped with religion and sex and TV. Think you're so clever and classless and free. But you're still fucking peasants as far as I can see. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. There's room at the top, they are telling you still. First you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me. If you want to be a hero, well, just follow me.
Attention. The Inter-Universal Weather Service has issued a severe red giant warning for the sun named Sol in the Charon system, in the outer arm of the Milky Way galaxy, 12 parsecs from Coruscant. The sun is a massive incandescent gas. It is due to turn into a red giant in 4.6 billion year. If you are in the area of the solar system, please seek shelter by developing some reasonable space program that will get your behinds off a doomed planet.
Wake up.
Sunday mornings, the irreverent Uncle Pete.
with your Sunday morning soft start, 8 to 10 a.m.
You must wake up.
Uncle Pete will bring you a kinder, gentler radio wake-up call.
Come on. Wake up.
That's Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m.
Wake up, love.
That soft starts Sunday mornings, 8 to 10 a.m. Only on 93.3 WNRB LP, Wausau.